Good morning, Pumelele. How are you? I can't hear you. For some reason, you're muted. What's going on over there? Jack, just switch Pumi on there so I can hear the woman. She didn't come there for her health. She came there to be part of the burning platform this morning.
But
All
she's
right,
going
good
to give
morning.
me feedback. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Thank you. Very good.
Okay. Yeah.
All
Sorry.
right, very good.
No, I did
Is
not come here for my health, and my health being, guys, take
what
this
is
vaccine. This flu is a killer.
it?
It's horrendous. I was out for a week, 2 weeks ago, and today I had to like drag myself by the tits to be here.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. That's terrible.
And then I'm here, and Jack has me on mute.
Right, well, Helen's in the comments already with her big hello. Hello, fabulous people. All right, we hope to bring you something fabulous this morning. It's always lovely to talk to Dion Chang and Bronwyn Williams. And Bronwyn and Dion, along with Faiza Khan, have written this book, which is called The Future. An incredible book, which I think will be quite enlightening. And we decided to step away from the hardcore politics of the GNU because, frankly, I don't know about you, but I'm so overhearing uneducated pedestrian opinions about what people think will happen from completely uneducated and frankly disconnected voices that have nothing to do with any inside information. I'm sick of hearing from people who are just trying to project their own hopes and fears onto what
You
might or
know,
might not happen.
what I did see that made me actually laugh out loud a couple of days ago is, do you remember how Julius Malema always had inside information on what was happening at the NEC, what was,
Yes.
and he'd have a press conference? I laughed so hard because somebody tweeted a thing that says, maybe Julius Malema's inside person has died because what does he not know?
Yeah, maybe it was Batabile Dlamini because she's no longer around there. So
Maybe it was Jackson Mthembu.
maybe it was Jackson Mthembu. Maybe I'm not the only one who's starting to just get a little bit tired of hearing speculation and the most outlandish speculation of all, because people are putting themselves in the middle of this. You can hear supposed analysts and journalists like throwing their own hopes and dreams and desires into the pot when they're busy projecting stuff on ENCA or whatever else. So I've had enough. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to look to the
This is
future.
going to be fun.
Yeah, and we're not going to look to the future with an eye to figuring out coalition politics. We're going to look to the future to try and identify what the 80 key trends for South Africa are. Now, we won't get to all 80 of those, but it's worth looking at as many of them as we can get. I also found a report which I find it very, very depressing, but maybe other people will find it a little less so. It's about Gen Z and it's from Vice. And obviously, Vice is a shit publication and they're a terrible, terrible media house. It's been completely, no, they are. And they've been completely captured by like woke idiots. And why I want to bring this up is because, we're always talking about young people. And Pumi, really, at the start of the podcast party, one of the things that we wanted to do. You were part of these discussions from the get-go, is to hear what young people are interested in, to hear what it is that motivates them. And this report from vice.com may give us some insights into what the world for those Gen Z activists actually looks and feels like, because maybe we'll understand, well, maybe we'll understand a little bit better if we get to hear this. So I'll bring that into the fray as well. Let us get straight to Bronwyn Williams without any further ado. Pumi Mashiro and I are very excited to speak to you. Bronwyn, how are you this morning?
Good, thank you. And yourself?
Magic, magic. All the better for seeing
Well,
you.
Robert, good to see you again.
It's great to see both of you so early on such a cold morning. It's always a treat.
Yeah. We're up and at 'em early, and I heard that you had your book launch last night because one of our listeners was there and said that they loved it and they would be joining us this morning. We're also joined by Kanthan Pillay, who, of course, is a big part of the Burning platform, and he is ready to throw a couple of questions and have some insights delivered to him personally this morning, too. So here we are, full compliments, Pumi, Kanthan, Bronwyn, and I. So I'm going to hand over to the great Pumi Mashiho, because she always likes to kick things off with a little research, which I... No, you do, and you're always paying attention to these things. Yeah,
I don't want to lie. I was a geek last night because I sat and I read through the report. I got the from Jack, and I said to Jack, "How did you get this PDF of like 100 pages? It was amazing." And also because I think when I first saw Flux, and kind of the Flux trends was 2009, and it was interesting because I went back to find that book as well to look at what was in there and look at what was in this, and it's quite interesting how much things have changed, but also how things have kind of ticked along, you know, in those years. Bruno, do you want to talk a little bit about first the differences between those two? But I don't think you were there in the 2009, but you've been with the organization long enough to tell us a little bit about what has stayed the same in these times of flux.
Well, that's certainly a great point. I mean, like the sort of trends that matter are trends that have legs that will stick around and cause chaos in their wake over some time yet to come. And as you rightly point out, many of the trends in this book are just an evolution of that. I mean, like I think Dion started talking about the whole climate change thing and how we are responding to it a long time ago. He also started talking about youth a long time ago. I mean, Dion's been tracking Gen Z since 2009. In fact, a little bit before that. I mean, he's got TED Talks out about this, and those trends have just continued up until to date. And now, of course, Gen Z are not babies anymore. They're now fully grown adults, and they should be making up the majority of our electorate if they were actually showing up to vote, for example, right? So again, like all these sorts of things continue on. Well, this is one of my favorite points at the moment. If you actually look at demography in South Africa, the 18 to 30-year-old cohort makes up over 49% of the eligible electorate of actual South African voters that could register to vote. So, you know, young people could show up and swing an election should they choose to. They just really haven't. And that kind of brings us
they don't care.
Gareth, don't be unfair. If we have been so disappointing.
there isn't anyone worth voting for from their perspective, Gareth.
I'm tired of parents like you two making excuses for this generation. You know what? I don't have any guilt over the way that these slacktivists of the Gen Z mold have so much responsibility placed upon them and so many hopes and dreams for the future by the rest of us. And they shirk that responsibility at every given opportunity. Case in point, our last election, Bronwyn. I mean, I'm not wrong.
You're not wrong. But the numbers are there. They don't lie.
No, but Gareth, sorry, Bronwyn, I just want to say, Gareth, it's not making an excuse. It's kind of the same way that when we looked at older people, we're like, I want to be like those fucking idiots. And that's what the young people are doing. That's why I'm telling you, we have been so disappointing that these young people are going, whatever those people are doing, I don't want to be part of that mess. And that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing them saying, we are such a fuck up, they don't want to be like us.
But are we though? I just want to put out there that we'll be talking about the book that we put out, which is like an evolution of trends over the last sort of 10 years and what's most important. Now, the other piece of content you're referring to is our Gen Z report that we did on South Africans locally, nothing to do with Vice in the US and what's going on that side of the world. But our local Gen Z report really picked up that most youth are apathetic, not so much disillusioned as disinterested, but there are a small minority that are more activist and another minority of about equal proportion who are fall into the anarchist camp, who would like willfully destroy the place given half the chance. So I think it's worth noting the nuances there. And I think that we have to also respect the fact that, as I said, Gen Z is now turning 30 this year, right? I mean, by that point, you're either part of the problem or you're doing something to address it, right? I mean, if you wait another couple of years, you end up like us, the millennials, who really complained a lot but didn't really do much.
Look, I'm more interested. So what? Let's look forward, because I don't want us to spend time having like intergenerational squabbles. As much as that's fun, as much as I know, I'll win, because these people aren't only lacking any desire to change things or any kind of energy to actually move things forward. They also aren't very well educated. We know that for a fact.
You're unlikely to win against my daughters.
I've met your daughter, your one daughter, and she's certainly smart. I'll give her that. But she is the exception. I'm telling you that the rule is quite disappointing. I'll get to that thing about Vice just now. But let's look at your six pillars, Bronwyn, because I think this is really interesting. So you've basically divided in this book the future of South Africa into technology, retail and marketing, economy, which is a much more comprehensive look, the natural world, diplomacy, and socio-cultural effects. Now, I mean, of all of those, I think Canton will probably want to start with the economy, so I'll open up with that one, and maybe you can just give us some pointers, and then I'll let him get into the details, because that's always the most important thing, and I wouldn't disagree with it.
Well, just a point there in terms of this book, although it's called The Future, 80 Key Trends for South Africa, they're not 80 key predictions for South Africa. Rather, they are a collection of 80 trends that are already happening in the world as it is that we think are going to have an impact on businesses and on individuals in South Africa. So we kind of divide our work into understanding the world so you can kind of change it, the world as it is, and then looking ahead is what it could be, if that makes sense. And this is very much a book based on what's currently going on. There's no speculation in there. It's more just interpreting what's already happening and why that is going to be important for people living here. So it's very much a collection of global trends that have therefore been localized. So things that local people might not have been thinking about or might not think impact them because we're so busy with news and load shedding and all the usual stuff that we haven't been able to sort of look up and look ahead at all the other sort of stuff that's coming at us, all these other ideas like those published in Vice that sort of find their way into our society, into our culture, and into our economy too, if that makes sense.
Cool. Okay, so listen, no one thinks that anyone else is Nostradamus. And there were only a few people who would have been proven to be right if they did that with the elections. But when we look at the economy going forward, what kinds of trends are you spotting rather than predictions that you're making with regard to South Africa's economy? And in particular, with the information that we have at hand now and a look at the world more generally, are we looking at a world where the economy is expanding, where there are more opportunities, particularly for those people in this country that are unemployed, for those people who have great ideas, who are motivated and want to make things happen? Is this economy a great environment for them to do that?
Well, it depends how you look at the economy, right? If you look at it from a sort of macro monetary economist perspective, then you're looking at expectations, right? And the sort of economies that have the best expectations for themselves are the economies that tend to do better over the long run, right? But if you're looking at the more sort of micro signals as to what's happening on the ground, we've got some less exciting signals. So I think it must be said that even as young people in South Africa might be apathetic, and even as older people might be disillusioned, South Africa has some of the highest degree of optimism about our society in the world. And that might just be a symptom of the expectations versus reality equation. If our expectations for our current government are quite low, we kind of at some point think, oh, it's got to get better sometime in the future. We feel like there is scope to improve, and scope to improve gives societies optimism, and optimism drives action. And this is why we have such an entrepreneurial culture here. Whether those businesses succeed or not, the fact is people are still opening them, which shows that we do have optimism, which is a pretty, that we put it into a positive column in terms of looking at South Africa's economy. On the other hand, we've got to deal with the world as it is, the present right now. And as I mentioned last night, the book launch, I think one of the most important trends that we put in the book might be dismissed by some people as being irrelevant, but I think it's symptomatic of what's going on in our economy, and in fact, the economy at large too. And that's the rise of what we term to be debt training wheels. Debt training wheels are essentially all those what I think are totally evil products that call themselves social enterprises or fintech businesses, but all they really do is give access to debt around the legalities of our credit system, right? The buy now, pay later services, the get your money before pay. all these things that are sold as being, you know, socially progressive, helping the poor. They're absolutely not helping the poor. They're getting you to spend money that you don't have. They're not solving the underlying problem, which could be solved by optimism and growing the economy and all the rest of it. And I think that's a really interesting trend, the sort of debt treadmill that you get trapped into through these debt training wheels that we talk about. People get access to debt outside of credit cards, outside of formal banks. It's right. fees, it's interest, but you get trapped and you get into this debt cycle. And debt is, of course, one of the really big problems in South Africa because we have such a low savings culture. And if you have a low savings culture, you don't have that investment to back that optimism and you get stuck. But this also rolls up if you look at what's happening with the with our general budgets, right? Or not just our budget. Look at America's budgets. And like, where's that debt being passed on to? Our debt-based economy globally is premised on the idea that we have to grow. Our GDP growth, whether you like the idea of GDP growth or not, a different story, has to rise and has to grow at a faster rate than our interest rate payments to pay back our debt. This is the trap and the treadmill of debt. The more indebted you are, the faster you have to grow to stay in the same place. But at the same time, globally, if you look at the sort of natural world or climates and nature chapter in our book, there's a whole lot of stuff going on around climates and responses to climates. And one of those responses that I'm sure many of your listeners will be very aware of is that whole idea, that really toxic idea, that really badly named idea of degrowth, which I think actually is good for South Africa, because if the rest of the world is toning down their optimism, we get to lean into our optimism, and we believe that growth is good and they believe that growth is bad, I say that as dire as all of the sort of debt-based treadmills that premise our entire global economy really are, I would say the people that believe in growth are the people that are probably best set up to grow in the future. And from my perspective, certainly, I still think that growth is good.
Okay.
It's a lot. Sorry, guys. It's a lot and it's a mouthful. And you know, and I think some of the stuff that you're talking about really also therein lies some opportunity for a country like South Africa that has such high unemployment. You know, and only if we can get the education factor right. And I don't know if we've gotten that right just yet. What do your trends say about where we sit just in that education spectrum and in terms of opportunities that we have to exploit, as it were?
Well, first I'll take it back even a little bit more, although that isn't in the book, it definitely informs our research, that while education is, of course, critical and while we are messing it up at pretty much every level, which I'll get to in a second, it starts before that. Like, you can't educate a child who didn't get adequate nutrition in the first 1,000 days of their life. So like when you start looking at university results and graduate unemployment, you're starting so far down the road, we actually have to start with literally feeding babies. So if you are a futurist and you want a high return on investment sort of project, feed babies so that your human capital can develop and can be educated and can achieve its full potential. So our education problem starts before kids even get to school. Let's just leave that there. But where we pick up in the book is really talking about the absolutely terrible breakdown in return on investment of higher education, whereby we now have, what was it, something like 800,000, almost a million graduates still on COVID social grants 3 years after COVID. Maybe that degree isn't exactly your ticket to the better future that you thought it was. Again, our recent research report backs up the trend that we put in the book before we wrote the research report or did the research. It shows that in our little group that we studied, 2/3 of them were unemployed and 2/3 of the unemployed had degrees, some of them multiple degrees. So something is sort of rotten in the house when it comes to higher education. Again,
it's culture professional students that we've got there, Bronwyn, basically, where because of the fact they've got access to things like NSFAS, which allow them to just simply stay at university and turn that into an ongoing period of enjoyment. So one of the things that I found kind of interesting was that this entire concept of delaying adulthood. And, you know, the idea that, but the interesting thing for me was that I didn't necessarily see not purchasing a car as being something that's an indication of delaying adulthood. Because, again, we've had this technological shift where we now have access to things like Uber, as an example, which I'm finding that increasingly you've got your Gen Z cohort that are now making use of that rather than actually tying themselves down with car payments. You know, as a very specific example, owning their own home, again, you know, from that perspective, I'm seeing lots of people basically you know, getting together a group of friends, renting homes together, which, you know, my generation would have called that communes, but it's still very much a thing. So I'm not sure to what extent this is an indication of a lack of wanting to get into adulthood on the part of this new generation, or maybe they're just simply redefining what adulthood is meant to be about. And maybe there's actually some merit in what they're doing. What do you think?
Yeah, so when it comes to this whole sort of concept of delayed adulthood or waited, it's not so much about young people not wanting to grow up, although that's, of course, the casual subtext reading that would be picked up by the likes of your sort of pop culture platforms, all the rest of it. It's more a case of young people being unable to achieve the markers of adulthood that still sit deeply in the psyche of the young person, him or herself. The person feels that they are unable to achieve or is literally not able to achieve those markers of adulthood that indicate independence from both the state and from their parents. In other words, it's this protracted adolescence in that you are still dependent on society for your basic needs. This is like living with your parents. It's like not being able to start a family or support children of your own. We've spoken to young people who want to do those things, but only when they're financially independent. You mentioned the cars and the houses. Again, it's quite interesting when you unpack the cause and the effect there. We look at young people forming, as you say, communes or whatever, like living together, co-ops and all the rest of it. And we say, or we make assumptions, oh, there's a shift in values. Young people don't want to own anymore. They're buying into the sharing economy. They just pay for mobility on the go on a pay-as-you-go basis. It's a shift in values, but it's actually not. When you talk to young people, they want to own their own house. They want to own their own car. They want to have those independence markers that previous generations had, because those means, those myths are so deeply baked into our collective psyche of that so-called American dream, right? Achieving these sort of markers that define a successful life. That what we're really seeing with waited and delayed adulthood is a frustration of young people at being unable to achieve what they've seen other generations and perhaps other cultures and other parts of the world achieve, right? So it's the sense of this being forced upon them rather than this actually being a path that they are choosing. And I think that cultural and trained analysts often try and conflate those issues. They see something happening, a pattern, and then they attribute, you know, causes to it that aren't necessarily real causes. We'd like to project our values onto particularly younger generations and lionize their virtue, which I think is really, really interesting too. And we do this even worse now with small children, to the point that we've now got boards in like Holland appointing 8 to 12-year-olds onto their boards to essentially be their morality counselors over climate, sustainability, gender, and justice issues, which is just absolutely incredible to me. I mean, some of you are parents, right? I mean, you've met small children. As Terry Pratchett says, the voices of children are great and all until you listen to what they're actually saying, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to resist the temptation to climb into how useless children are again, because I actually think that one of our big pluses is that we're still having children in this country, and I think that one of the best things about South Africa is that we have potential for growth, where countries like Japan and Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, are really struggling to get people to even have kids. We may have socioeconomic pressures on us, but at least we have a next generation. Those countries don't. They're in big trouble with that inverted population pyramid, right?
De facto degrowth. And again, it comes back to what I was saying with those longer run reasons why we are optimistic. And we can back that up by fact. I mean, if you want to look at the absolute optimism of a society, is are they having babies? Like a pessimistic society doesn't believe they have a future, doesn't have children. And there's almost nothing you can do to make them have children. I mean, you mentioned some of these countries that have de facto degrowth, like really collapsing inverted population pyramids. And there's almost nothing that they can do to actually incentivize people to have children. There are places that are giving away free houses for every baby you have. Or if you have children, you won't pay income tax for the rest of your life. Incredible incentives. But there is pretty much no amount of money you can give, particularly a woman, to have a baby that doesn't want to have a baby. And we've just seen these incentives fail and fail and fail in countries, because what you really need, if you want to have people believe in the idea of having babies, is you have to have people that believe in the idea of a future, which is something that many societies have given up believing in. They're now ashamed of their present and they don't want to perpetuate that into the future. And that reflects in a degrowing society. And I think that every society has got a question for themselves whether you want to buy into that. Do we as Africans want to buy into Europe's shame about themselves and shame about being human, which is one of these like really toxic ideas that creeps in with these sorts of degrowth type movements?
You know, Bronwyn, I think that if you do a look at the collective West, that's probably true. But if you look in terms of the BRICS countries, that's probably not true.
Because Brazil
doesn't have degrowth. China, after the disastrous one-child policy, has been clawing its way out of it. India is very comfortable with its population growth. Russia has been doing a lot of those incentives that you were speaking about in terms of actually, you know, paying women to stay at home and have kids. And we're seeing this, you know, to some extent in some of the cultures that looked quite disparagingly upon by most of the Western media. Hungary, for example, has been putting in those financial incentives. And so they once again in a positive growth spurt. But the more crucial thing for me is whether this shift in values, I think, is kind of a more critical piece of the puzzle for me. Because if the concept of, you know, what, you know, my generation used to think of as being a good future, which is, you know, buying the house, buying the car, starting the family, and all of that kind of stuff. Whereas the choices that are now open to the generation that you've been taking a look at are probably to the extent that if they don't go down that particular path, are they still able to have a comfortable life? And is there enough of a social support network that's going to give that to them? So, you know, things like national health programs, for example, or if you have a country that has a sovereign wealth fund and is actually paying you on an ongoing basis, you know, the urge to actually be getting out and doing stuff just from the basis of survival is not there anymore. So, but the other thing that I wanted to find out, in your studies, did you come across any significant difference in terms of the urban versus the rural mindset? Because I think that's the more interesting one for me.
I'm not sure there's so much of a difference between the rural and urban mindset, certainly not from the young people that we spoke to. In fact, what we found was their values, their optimism, their thoughts around big issues like family, like religion, like country, like patriarchy, all of those sorts of big topics. There was a lot of commonality between different genders, different races, different parts of the world people grew up in. The mindset of young people was more homogenous than what we had perhaps expected. I think that this is a symptom of the fact that even if you are living in a rural community in some tiny little town in the middle of nowhere, you still have access to the great sort of global media system that we all kind of swim in, the sort of porridge or the soup that is the internet, for better or for worse. And I know some people find that absolutely horrific, but at the same time, it has been a sort of flattening, not just of culture, not just of style, not just of taste, but also it's been a sort of flattening of values, that you find that values among young people and also in different parts of the world that used to be polar opposite now become more similar. Well, there are some exceptions. I'm glad you brought up the whole sort of BRICS thing. And there is kind of a reason South Africa is aligned with BRICS, in that the countries that you mentioned there all have that, as I said, evidence-based optimism in the fact that you're having babies, you believe in growth, you're building things, you're doing things, you're making yourself bigger and making yourself smaller. But there's other studies that back that up too, in terms of things like technology and artificial intelligence. If you ask children or young people, teenagers, early 20s, people going to university, different parts of the world, what they think about AI in the future, Westerners in the sort of weird West, that sort of Western, industrialized, educated, you know, the weird West, they tend to be afraid of AI and see AI as taking away their privilege, making their life smaller, a threat, maybe even an existential threat to humanity. Whereas if you ask people in the rest of the world, which is now the majority of the world, so if you look at, like, you know, as you said, India, China, all these giant countries, young people, they see AI as an enabler, as progress. And I think that that's a really interesting difference. And not so much between rural and urban, but really between the countries and the cultures that are buying into the idea of a future and those that really aren't. And I think that this speaks to privilege in general. And I think that even our historically privileged here in South Africa will know this. The privileged are not always the most receptive to change and to progress, because progress, if you already have kind of everything that you want, can see as a can be seen as a threat to your privilege, right? Whereas if you have still scope to grow, you see progress as being an opportunity to grow with that. And that's very much a mindset shift. But I think that that comes from the culture that you live in. It comes from like seeing problems around you and seeing these things have to be solved. And weirdly, it seems like, and you picked up on that point too, but where we have problems, there is the sense that you have to solve it. It's almost this case that the more problems you have, the more optimism you have, which is a kind of a dangerous idea when you unpack it. But at the same time, when you have too much privilege, when you're too rich, when you've got a lazy girl job and you live in some big city in America or Europe, and all you do is show up and make the coffee, and yet you go home to a really comfortable life in a heated apartment, how much sort of impetus do you really have to improve things? And why would you want to rock the boat or let anyone find out that you really do have a minimum effort bullshit job, as David Graver spoke about? You know, these jobs where you overpay, you do not very much. Of course, those people don't want to talk about progress and AI. They're the ones that are going to get caught out. Whereas some young entrepreneur sitting in Africa or sitting in Asia sees this as a chance to build a life for him or herself. So, you know, there is that point that you're making there, that unearned privilege is definitely a dampener on optimism and on agency or action.
So, I mean, I love that, the idea of a changing perspective, right? And where the West sits and where the rest of the world is sitting. And I'm interested to know, because I did see something also in your report about democracy in decline worldwide. Mm-hmm. So what those changes and what the shifting kind of value system and flattening of that value system looks like in terms of future scoping for where we are.
Yeah. So when it comes to the decline in democracy, I'll speak to the South African cohort that we looked at first, because it is a global phenomenon among younger people. So what we found is that young people we interviewed are very bought into the idea of democracy in theory. When you ask them, do you like democracy? Is democracy a good idea? Do you support democracy? Is voting great? Yeah. We like democracy. Democracy is good. But when you sort of interrogate it and you scratch beneath the surface and you ask them about alternatives they'd be willing to explore, much like the international cohort, and there's been many studies, they're open to more authoritarian forms of leadership. They're not actually going to show up to vote themselves. Yes, democracy is great in theory. In practice, it's not working for me. I'm not actually participating in it. In practice, I would vote for someone who might even reduce my democratic rights if it meant me actually getting a job or getting a house or getting some sort of progress. So we've seen the shift towards authoritarianism among younger generations, which again, I find that very validating, because there was the sense among many cultural trained analysts, political analysts, about the sort of continual march towards sort of left-leaning politics. But I was like, no. Every generation rebels against the previous generation. And we've seen quite a dramatic swing towards young people being open to supporting authoritarians, more right-wing parties in Europe. That's how it's evidenced there. Here in Africa, it's more sort of strong type leaders, looking for the big men leaders. Again, a common theme. I mean, we saw how many people voted for MK here. I mean, this is very much a sort of right-wing party that we're talking about, even if our politics is a little bit twisted. You know, like there's ideas of big men, authoritarians that will alleviate the burden of personal choice and responsibility. So for me, this is again a symptom of apathy rather than actually a symptom of rebellion it is a form of rebellion, but rather than of sort of revolution, it's more a case of, can we get away with sort of deferring our authority to someone else that we can get on with making like TikToks or being an entrepreneur, depending on how ambitious you are, right? Well, sort of like, let someone else we don't want to be part of that.
If anybody listening to this tries to kind of distill this through ChatGPT now, I think what they'll get is, and I'm trying to be charitable about this with all of us, because we are looking for solutions. Here's what they're going to get is, people want free material stuff or really cheap material stuff. They want to live comfortably. They want to have all the options that are possibly available to them. They want to do no work. They want to be able to live outside of any values structures that existed before, like religion or hard work or families or any of that stuff. And they think that's just going to work. I mean, it's amazing to me how detached from reality so many people are. If you look at climate change, and we've got to talk about this because I think it's an ongoing area of just incredible stupidity. You know, Rutger Bregman, who I know you're also familiar with, Bronwyn. Rutger Bregman wrote this book, Humankind, not so long ago. And I know you guys refer to it in your book. But, you know, if you look at the work from people like Stephen Koonin and Bjorn Lomborg and Patrick Moore, and, you know, those kind of people are writing about the fact that, for example, the coral reefs are better than they've ever been. Forests, reforestation is happening. Carbon dioxide is not the worst thing for everything outside of, like, the climate change people's perspective. The plants love it. It's good for everything else. These are boom times for climate. And yet, I think people are navel-gazing pessimistically in parts of the world. South Africa shouldn't be feeling that way. We should be thrilled that we've got natural resources that we can make use of. We should be thrilled that we've got people who are hungry for work and are optimistic to get out there and make a difference. But we're being dictated to by people in the rest of the world, aren't we?
Well, let's talk about the climate change thing. I think first of all, the climate is changing. Like there is change, right? And change creates, much like growth, it creates some new winners and perhaps some new losers who don't benefit from it. And this is the sort of awful, unspoken elephant in the room when it comes to any climate conversations. And again, at multinational levels too, there's this fact that some people are better off when the climate changes in one way, and other people are better off when it changes in another way. And this is very uncomfortable to talk about, because, like, if the Arctic is melting, suddenly China and Russia have new sea routes. Oh, look again, how maybe climate change plays out differently from an incentive perspective, from a BRICS perspective, than it does from a West perspective, where Europe is getting, frankly, too hot in the summer and then too cold in the winter, right? So there's definitely places that are more winners, more losers here. Durban here in South Africa, obviously not having a great time with shifting climate at the moment, but other parts of Africa becoming more fertile, right? So you've got these terrible mixed incentives. And what you see around the climate conversation is people advocating for the incentives. These are big incentives. These are incentives that cause some people to lose their homes and some people to lose their livelihoods, lose their industries, and cause other people to get really rich. And this is why we start to get to see really horrifying things like geoengineering at the moment, or rain stealing, where like China seeds the rains that falls on their sides, that India's monsoons are messed up, or Dubai messes around with the weather and causes floods, you know, like, but it definitely wasn't rain seeding. As Dubai said, which is my favorite sort of climate change anecdote, after there was floods in the deserts, they were like, oh no, that's definitely not man-made climate change in the form of geoengineering, but it's definitely caused by man-made climate change. So it was like planes rain, not the actual planes seeding the sky. It's just incredible. So man-made climate change definitely messed up Dubai's weather. Who's to blame for it? Different question. You see, we can always play blame and parts blame here, but the stakes are so high when you're looking at the fact that there are islands that are sinking at the moment, where there are populations that are having to be moved. Like, you got the island Tuvalu, who now has been giving citizenship in Australia because their whole country is sinking, right? So you've got these worse incentives, but you've also got these big countries who are able to make macro decisions that affect all of us. Now we're talking about the EU not liking the current version of climate change, wanting to, you know, spray silver or spray metal particles into our global planetary ecosystem to block out the rays of the sun. Whereas if you're living in Johannesburg and your winter is a couple of degrees warmer, you might not want that, you know? But like, who gets to make these decisions? Who doesn't? And the stakes behind them are so high. You have to sort of take every solution for climate change with an incredible grain of salt. And my favorite sort of debate at the moment is the debate around air conditioners, like whether poor people in hot areas should be allowed to have them because they contribute to climate change. Or look at like fireplaces in Scotland, which has just banned wood and coal burning stoves. I mean, Scotland is pretty freaking cold, right? In order to sort of mitigate the effects of climate change, which is so ironic, because at the end of the day, most of us just
or carbon taxes, or carbon taxes and just,
or don't get me started on carbon
taxes or just transitions.
As an economist, I'll tell you, markets are very good at making more of things. So don't make markets for bads. If you want less carbon, don't make a market for it. Or you end up with power chips being magically turned green by purchasing already existing game farms. It's incredible.
I guess we could go down this climate change rabbit hole for quite a bit, but I wanted to just swing us back to the generational shift. And one of the things, Bronwyn, that I frequently end up quoting at various talks that I give people in terms of shifts that are happening, is something that Douglas Adams said many years ago. You might remember him, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he said that he came up with a set of rules that describe our reactions to technologies as a species. And so the first rule is that anything that's in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary, and it's just a natural part of the way in which the world works. Anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 is new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. And anything that's invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things in terms of your headspace. And I think what we are seeing right now in the world, using the examples that we've been talking about, like cloud seeding, like artificial intelligence, the dramatic shifts in terms of technology, are so scary for the over 35s that they're tending to kind of double down in terms of the spaces that they're in right now. Whereas for that younger generation, it's just part of something that they've grown up with. They're immersed in it. And, in terms of getting a career in it, I think those careers are being worked on right now as we are speaking. So I think that what we are seeing is a kind of amplification of this entire process, where the technology shifts are so scary to the older generation. There are exceptions, like Gareth says. So, for example, I'm still coding in my 60s, and I'm deeply immersed in all of these systems, and so I have a sense of what's going on, and it doesn't terrify me. But I strongly suspect that people significantly younger than me, and I'm not looking at you, Pumi, who don't code, are probably likely to find this stuff terrifying. Do you think that?
I don't know why you think I don't code.
I strongly disagree with that, because I think it depends on what the technology is. I think that assessment applies to social media, and that's because old people really don't like young people talking to each other. Because as much as we like in public to pretend that youth is equated with virtue, those of us who have actually spent time with small children, as I mentioned earlier, kind of know that young people, when they get together, or if they show up to vote, like I said, in South Africa, they can mess things up. So I think that a lot of the moral panic around social media with older people not liking it is because we don't like young people talking to each other and getting too powerful or knowing too much too soon. But when it comes to other technologies, if you're talking about cloud seeding, you're talking about Mars colonies, you're talking about even about AI, I actually see much more fear among younger people with these technologies than with older people. And that is because a lot of the technologies that we're seeing now, particularly the artificial intelligence thing that we're seeing now, I mean, that's a terrible word, but it's basically these highly automated technologies that allow us to automate tasks. What they do is they entrench power and privilege, right? They entrench the incumbent, and they actually don't make space for as many new people to come in. And I think young people are quite aware of that. But I would say, again, that's more young people in developed knowledge-based economies that are based on bullshit jobs, because a bullshit job is like a self-eating, like snake eating its own tail, right? And there's only sort of so much space. And yes, it creates and destroys bullshit jobs, but those who already have them, those who work in big consulting companies, those that already have houses, the boomer generation, like if they're so anti at the moment in America, Generation X understands this, that you already have a certain amount of, you've already built a business, you've actually added value, you've created real value. You can use these technologies to automate that and to become more efficient. Whereas if you don't actually haven't actually added value yet, this becomes harder and harder to find your place within the system. And I think that young people, particularly in developed, overprivileged societies, understand this at a deep psychological level, even if not at an intellectual level. Whereas, again, in countries that still have actual problems to be solved like our own, this is why we see more optimism to do with technology across the age spectrum here in the more developing markets. Here, you might find more older people that conflate technology with magic because they simply didn't have the educational background to have fully intellectualized how these things work just due to a lack of privilege as they were growing up. So you might find that sort of resistance at the mysticism level, but it's not actually at a generational level. That's more just a case of historical lack of privilege. That's not actually a case of the mindset being anti-technology. So I would say actually the biggest resistance we're seeing to technology, and for good reason, because people do tend to act in their own interests, is actually among the most privileged younger people that we're seeing. And particularly, again, around Generation Z, which is really, really interesting. Not so much, again, here in South Africa. So you can sort of like cut that into sort of almost four quadrants to consultingify this conversation a little bit.
So in other words, it ties in with the optimism that you've been speaking about.
Yeah, it ties in with the optimism of where the problems are and who stands to win and who stands to lose. And this is what's really interesting about, I would say, the last sort of 3-4 years is how many tipping points have materialized around what was a winner and what was a loser. My favorite one is around sort of the high touch versus high tech technology when it comes to education, right? You know, like not so long ago, pre-COVID, 2018, 2019, it was rich kids who had iPads and laptops in schools, right? Rich kids had access to technology to accelerate their education. Poor kids did not. Suddenly COVID happens and now rich kids are in micro schools with 7 kids, basically like a Victorian sort of au-pair setup, very high touch, highly personal education. And poor kids have like, you know, purple mesh or whatever sort of system like the government has displayed and like good luck and learn for yourself among the internet kids, you know, which is a much lower quality education, right? So it's like technology went from being a luxury for the poor to like a requirement for the masses. And we saw this around so many different shifts like that have been happening here. And it's all part of that same conversation, I think.
You know, Bronwyn, you bring up quite an interesting thing about how inverted the world became around COVID and what COVID necessitated for all of us. And I'm very interested to know what interpersonal relationships in terms of your research, what interpersonal relationships look like going forward, you know, talking about how we shop, how we interact with each other, and how society is now organized.
Yeah, so in the book, we talk about the hermit consumer. It's one of these really big shifts. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Again, this was a COVID thing. Like, it's like $600 or $800 billion shift in spending patterns that people used to spend out of home that now spend in home. This is people that aren't going to restaurants. This is people that are ordering in Uber Eats or e-hailing services. This is people that aren't going to shops, but rather purchasing online and getting it delivered to your door. So it's this immense convenience economy, but it's also an economy that's it's a symptomatic of a society that has less third spaces, that has less places where people meet serendipitously, where it has less places where you interact with real human beings. I think this comes back to the previous conversation around technology and young people and old people and the moral panic around social media. Jonathan Haidt's got that book out at the moment that's busy like maligning social media as being the satanic panic of our age. You know, like satanic, ban it, don't let the kids on social media. And again, I think it's a very bad conflation of cause and effect. Like there's this assumption that social media has made our kids sad, it's made girls depressive, you know, done all those things to the kids that make messing with their mental health. But at the same time, I would say you got to take a step back and say, why are kids on that social media and what are they learning on it? Social media is a mirror. It's a reflection of society. And what you're really seeing is a broken society reflected and disseminated wholesale across all young people all across the world. It's those bad messages that are messing with the kids' minds. And the fact that teenagers don't have spaces to be teenagers embodied anymore. Like, I'm not that much older than Generation Z, but I'm still old enough to remember going to the mall or going to the park to hang out with people that might not be your friends, but they were certainly your peers. So you had that like physical socialization. Previous generations, good old Generation X, had even more. They got to ride around on their bikes across different suburbs and like go AWOL for a bit. And we don't have that space anymore. So young people only see each other through a screen. That's not the fault of social media. That's the fault of society. Not having safe spaces or physical spaces or third spaces for people to actually connect. This is all tied together with the sort of hermit consumer thing. So what we sort of gain in terms of efficiency, we lose in terms of socialization, and we lose it badly. I mean, we're looking now at like what the stats say that like, you know, like a quarter to a third of young people don't have any friends at all. You've got many people who like your pictures online, but you don't have any physical friends. That's not to say that social media did that to us. In fact, social media is trying to fix that. The fact that we don't have friendships is actually to do with how our societies are physically structured, the rules that we impose upon our children, how safe it is for children to play outside. It's not Facebook's fault that my kid can't play with her neighbors. That's the fault of South Africa's crime problem, right? It's physically not safe to do that. So social media is kind of an alternative. It's a cheap, much like the online education, it's a cheap alternative to fix a bigger problem, right? So you got to sort of like unpack what the problem is, what the cause is, what the effect is, and where this is all coming from. And everything's connected when you start pulling on these threads. I think so many of the things we've spoken about today sort of tie back to the fact that our society and the stories that we tell about it and the means we have are perhaps where we need to start looking.
In your book, you also refer to there's a very good chapter about next generation political leadership, and I think this is exciting to me because we are at a stage in human development which is, I think, full of opportunity, and that is that we can now decide to run things differently. We can decide to do things differently. We can decide to apply ourselves, those of us who are active and willing to get involved, in new and exciting ways. And you've picked up a couple of trends in the kinds of next generation political leadership, which I think will make people feel a little bit better, because there's always this ongoing underlying conversation. It's like an always on thing of, oh, there's no leadership and leadership is failing. And who are the leaders of today? And I'm sure every generation has this problem. I'm sure all of us, regardless of our age, are all thinking this because we're not getting the kinds of leaders that we were taught about in nursery school, you know, the people who will, you know, lead you. And then we think history is kind of stopped when we were born and that everything that comes afterwards is going to be rubbish. That's not true. I mean, there are leaders. There are people who are showing themselves to be leaders in ways that were unforeseen by people 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So like this generation, I said, there's a large cohort of them that are apathetic, but there's also an activist cohort that's had outsized sort of impacts on society, even while they were still teenagers. Whether that sort of momentum continues is yet to be seen. But I'm going to digress slightly because I've sort of termed all of this, these sorts of youth activists, young leaders doing things outside the system, not necessarily within the system. I mean, we know they're not exactly excited to vote for the people that we have on the ballot. But this extracurricular politics trend is, I think, really interesting. And just looking at what's happened in the news on the last week in Kenya, where young people put their lives on the line, some of them were violently attacked in order to protest the increases in taxes there. And they got the government now, I think the news has come through, to actually reverse their course, right? This is the sort of actual activism that we've seen. And we've got local examples too, like the Ratepayers Association down in Durbs that just refused to pay their municipal taxes over to a municipality that wasn't delivering services, you know? And then you sort of get these small sort of wins in court, these sort of like working around the system, even if you can't necessarily work through it. And of course, there's more sort of the ones you might expect, the activist investors, the young guy in Australia who sued his pension fund for investing in petrol-based companies, not because they were poisoning the planet, but because he said that was an unsound investment decision. Because he believed that in the future, petrol companies were going to be banned by governments or have their profits reduced. In other words, at a purely crassly commercial level, this guy sued and won his pension fund for investing in the old economy, not for investing in the new, shifting the conversation in different ways. And of course, you know about the other sort of prominent young activists. We don't need to give them more airtime here. But you've got these individual characters who have made an outsized impact on very big issues, whether it be climate, whether it be gun laws, whether it be what's going on in Gaza at the moment, whether it be taxes now in Kenya, whatever it might be. They are young people that do care and do make a difference, even if they do make up a very small cohort. And again, I think Gareth Van Olsen put out a very in-depth research report just before our elections that sort of backed up our sort of thesis there. But around sort of 80% of the generation, quite apathetic. And then you got sort of 10%, 10 to 20% who are active, either active in a progressive, constructive way, like these activists we're talking about, or active in a more sort of perhaps regressive anarchist kind of way, like look at our Letwezi movement here in South Africa, or some of the more destructive, shall we say, student political movements that we've seen. So you've got a majority that's going to be led and nudged by those that do care, and hopefully those that do care about nice things win out over those who care about destruction, nihilism, and anarchy.
Which is essentially the way that it's always worked. I mean, it is essentially the way that it's always worked. It's always been a few who lead the charge.
Exactly.
But I'm also intrigued at the fact that we've spent so much time talking about young people when there is clearly a trend that we are living longer and we are having more vitality into later stages of our life, which actually means that even Canton, you know, has a longer runway to go.
I think it's true that there is
a longer runway, but we haven't spent nearly as much time talking about the fact that we are living longer and we do have more vitality into later stages of our life and what that means for all of us, you know, that are not Gen Z.
Yeah, well, I think that makes us more expensive, but it makes us more expensive, particularly for Gen Z, who's going to be paying for our social entitlements, because entitlements don't decline, they incline over time. And longer lives mean more expensive citizens, which is a really interesting shift also took place around about the COVID times, where we started seeing governments seeing citizens as liabilities, not as assets. This goes back to our conversation around growth and degrowth. And this is a sort of an emerging, insidious kind of debate that's not been said, but has kind of been done if you look at what's happening across the world, where you start to see previously population growth was tied with economic growth. And the more people you had, it meant you had that demographic dividend, your whole economy grew. That's what happened with China. Whether that happens to the same extent with India is a question. And what about Africa? We've got our demographic dividend peaking in 2050. But if that demographic dividend, people are not matched with productivity, in other words, those people, your young working age population is unemployed, like, oops, it kind of is all across Africa. Having more people is not a blessing. It's not a rising tide. It's a curse. It's suddenly a demographic disaster. And there's a sort of, we see this really insidious shift in governments seeing people as liabilities and not as assets on the so-called like national ledger. And this is what happens when people are dependent on social grants and not actually income taxpayers, right? Now suddenly your government sees you as a drag and not as an asset. Look at Canada. This is my favorite one, with their euthanasia. Yes, recommending suicide, not just to the sick and to the elderly, but to the poor and indigent, right? Like, we're not going to pay for your social housing anymore, but we will pay to kill you so that you're not homeless. Like, which one would you like? You know, like, it's take or death, if only it's not such a nice equation. And this is, for me, really symptomatic of the shift in mindset around certain public sector accountants who are effectively kind of running the world that have to make these sorts of decisions. And this is a really dangerous idea that we're hoping we won't get into too much today, but it ties together very, very deeply with these extended lifespans. And that is the fact, honestly, comes back to youth apathy, participation, all of these sorts of things. If you're not adding value to your society, sooner or later, somebody is going to start to see you as a liability. This is the same thing of young girls who have bullshit jobs making coffee in some tech company, to all the way through to some young person that can't find a job, that's trapped and waited, all the way through to old people who are living longer but retired 40 years ago and are living off society. All of these people have very good reason to be frightened about the future. But all the people that are adding value to society, whether they be a retiree that's gone back to start a business, and then we talk about them in the book too, these sort of like the older age, sort of recycled entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them, whether you're talking about a young entrepreneur starting a business in somewhere in Southeast Asia, embracing AI, all of those sorts of people have very good reason to be excited about the future. And it's really scary or really exciting, again, depending on your mindset, and also depending on whether you are contributing or whether you are, and you know that you are, living off other people.
And that's so why I've got a very crucial question that I need to get an answer to. because now you've got all of this information at our disposal. How do we end up making money out of the information that you've got?
Well, it's entirely up to you. Take any of these terms, see the problem, solve the problem. That's where value comes. Value comes solving someone else's problem.
I don't know what's going on there, but it sounds like you've got like an industrial plant. Is
no,
it not
it's
you?
Someone else's feed.
It's Bumi. Okay. I couldn't hear you at all. Sorry. So just say that again about the information.
This is a conspiracy theory here, Gareth. As soon as we start talking about the money, we get cut off.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Well, if you want to make money off any of these trends, we've articulated quite a few problems here. Solve some of those problems. If you solve a problem, you're adding value and you will be valued sooner or later. This is the sort of big message of that ties together everything that hopefully I've said here today. That's what we need to do. We need to both add value and be valued. We have to value each other, dignity, all of those sorts of things. But also we have to contribute, and we have to contribute towards the sort of future that we want, in that the future, much like the economy, is to think that the sum total of all of our choices and what we choose to spend our time, our money, our attention on.
Love it. So I do like Carl's comment here, Bronwyn, and don't take it as an insult. I think it's a huge compliment. He says, Bronwyn has said more words in this hour than I have so far this year. Super smart, super interesting. So I think that's
the compliments.
Right, well, I mean, we could carry on talking to you for hours, and I think there are probably a few more questions that are in the comments section. I don't want us to go on too long, but I wonder if we can keep you for just 5 minutes, because there are a couple of things being said here by people like Bitcoin Boot, and we haven't really touched on the idea of crypto and whether or not that's actually a thing, because there are still people out there who are doubtful of that, believe it or not. The other one is that people are talking about such disparate places as Saudi Arabia and El Salvador. Again, both interesting cases in point. A lot of people are talking about Argentina at the moment because they've managed to reverse 30 years of trends in the negative direction under Javier Milei. Do you have any comments on those things just before we carry on?
On those things? Those are a whole lot of things all sort of thrown in together. But
try to squeeze as much out of you as we can get in a little bit of time we have.
I think that the Argentina one is quite interesting, as is what's happening now with both France and the UK, where it looks like they're also probably going to get quite political flips, probably France flipping more towards the right. That's certainly the sort of indication at the moment. And all indications are that the UK might flip in the opposite direction. And what I think this is, these are all, I think, positive trends, in that, much like the same disruption we've seen here in South Africa, that when the other guys get a chance to try out new ideas and put them into practice, you can kind of see what works and what doesn't. Argentina has upset a lot of people who would really like them to fail, because a lot of people don't want those sorts of policies to work, but you know, like, gravity still pulls down, you know, and the sun still shines, and you got all these sort of laws of economic physics that we have to work towards that are interesting to see. But I think the flips in the opposite direction too can be good for society, and that's what a healthy country does, or at least a healthy democracy does, allow different people to try different ideas at different times. And that's how you get friction, that's how you get movement, that's how you get velocity. And I think velocity in terms of politics and economics is generally a good thing, because movement is much better than sort of stagnating. And it's always, it's interesting to see, and to see things that people thought would never change, changing, and changing quite rapidly in different directions, for better and for worse, in all parts of the world. And I include South Africa among that. Many people didn't think that we would get to this point with our coalition politics. And now it just happened yesterday. And now already we're laughing about the GNU, and it's already an old joke that only happened 2 weeks ago. So it's interesting how quickly things can change very deeply. And I think that's generally a good thing. When you get, once you get on with the Bitcoin type things, I think that unfortunately/fortunately, depending on what your politics are, the most interesting thing that Bitcoin did for us is that enlightened central bankers and governments across the world as to the possibilities, the absolutely amazing governance possibilities of digital identities, which is going to be a whole fun topic for the next century that our children are going to have to live with. Because, you know, there's so many opportunities that could come with that, but there's also, you know, so much very, very scary authoritarian things that can go along with it. And when you sort of pair the possibilities of digital identity with a young generation that's tending more priestly, more authoritarian, more self-righteous, well, the future could be a very, very interesting place for geriatric Gen X's, as you guys live for quite a long time, right? In other words, be nice to your kids.
Right.
I think that, Gareth, I have one last thing that I would like to ask and talk about, which, speaking about fun topics into the future, is a very interesting concept that I read when I was preparing for the show, which is joy therapy, which I think the world could use a lot more joy. Talk to us a little bit about that, Bronwyn, and what that means. What does that mean, and how it is manifesting itself?
Well, okay, it can mean all sorts of different things. But yes, people are essentially paying people to be their friends. I mean, we know like everyone has to have a therapist these days, right? I mean, like paid friendships. Joy as a service. Yes, that's definitely something that we're seeing. You see the laughing retreats, much like the ice bath retreats and all these sorts of things. Although all of these things do sound quite fun, I think that they're probably some of the darkest trends that we've got in the book, because this is the commercialization and the commoditization of things that probably shouldn't be commercialized or commoditized. Like, you know, paid friends, paid joy, all of these sorts of things, I think, speak to a very, very, very sick society, right? But if you want to end on a happy note, let's pretend joy therapy is just about being happy, right?
Right. Well, I'm sorry for that's great. That's a lot to think about, a lot to listen to this morning, and a lot to take in. So I would encourage anybody who wants to know more to take a look at Bronwyn and Dion Chang and Faiza Khan's book. It is called The Future, More Than 80 Key Trends for South Africa. It's also been it's been made a specialist publication for our country in this very critical and interesting time. And I think it's a really terrific read. I skimmed through it. I didn't read it in depth last night, as I'm sure Pumi will. And Pums, it's coming straight to you after this. But thank you. I know you've had a very busy week launching the book. I only wish you the best of luck with it. And tell Dion and Faiza we say well done too.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks, so everybody. We'll catch you next week right here on The Burning Platform on the podcast party. Make sure you subscribe and like and get all those notifications so you don't miss out on every little bit. Thank you very much. Cheers.